Accession number 4510, Reel 1.
Colonel Grove, Reel 1. Can you tell me something, first of all, Colonel Grove, about your family and educational background?
Yes, my father was a soldier originally and then joined the consular service. My grandfather was a soldier. I went to school at Repton in Derbyshire and then on to Sandhurst. We lived in Kent and still do. And that's about it, I think.
So it was a natural decision for you to go into the army in view of your family?
Well, yes and no. I rather thought, my parents were not very well off, and I'm afraid I concentrated a lot more on games at school than I should have done. And I was quite convinced that I should never pass the Sandhurst entrance exam. So I thought I would enlist. So I went to the headmaster, who later became Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Fisher, Lord Fisher. And he said, well, I'll have to see what your father says. Anyway, my father said, well, if you feel like that, all right. And I thought I'd enlist. And he said, no, we can't have that. So he sent me to a crammer, which was marvellous. I only did one term there, and I passed halfway up the list in Sandhurst. How they did it, I don't know. Anyway, so I went to Sandhurst from there. Admittedly, my background, my elder brother was already in the army, and so the background was fairly military.
How did you find the course at Sandhurst?
I thought it was splendid. Excellent. Thinking back, the only thing they didn't teach us much about was soldiering. It was quite good academically and theoretically, but we never did an exercise as such or anything.
What about your early service?
Can I smile?
Certainly, yes.
I was posted to the 2nd Battalion of the Royal West Kent Regiment, which fortunately was my choice. And they were then stationed at Shorncliffe, and we went to Shorncliffe for 2 years.
And was it at Shorncliffe that you got your Middle East posting?
From Shorncliffe, yes. Yes.
What was your reaction when you heard that you were going to Palestine?
Well, thereby hangs another funny story. I was told to go to India after I'd been at Shorncliffe about a year. And my eldest brother had been in India for, I think, 12 years, I'm not sure, with his regiment. And I thought, oh, crikey, the last thing in the world I want to do is go to India for 12 years. So another chap said, well, if you don't want to, I will. So he went, and I didn't. And then a year later, we were posted, told to go to Palestine, which I was looking forward to, and all the chaps that had gone to India that hadn't done their time abroad all joined us in Palestine, so it wouldn't have made any odds anyway. No, I was quite pleased about going to Palestine.
Why were you pleased?
Oh, I don't know. I'd done 2 extremely good years, enjoyed them very much in England, and I thought, well, now it's time to see the world a bit. One of the reasons one joined the army in the old days.
Did you know very much about the situation in Palestine?
No, not really. I knew little that there had been a sort of Arab revolution, but I didn't know much about it.
Did the army itself give any briefing to the troops going out?
Yes. Brigadier Jack Evitts wrote a pretty complete brief, which the colonel put over to us all before we went there. So fairly near the time when we were going to go, we were all pretty well in the picture then.
And how did you travel out?
We sailed on the 28th of January, I think it was. Must have been 1937. We got a troop train from Shorncliffe at 3 o'clock in the morning. Went down to Southampton in that, and there we got on board the troop ship California.
What were conditions like on it?
I oughtn't to say too much about the soldiers' conditions, but they weren't too bad, as a matter of fact. This was a sort of requisition ship. It wasn't built as a troop carrier. So as far as I remember, most of the troops had cabins of some sort. And the officers' conditions were absolutely splendid, excellent, and the food magnificent.
Why were the conditions so splendid?
Well, I mean, I think the officers all travelled in the first-class cabin sort of thing, that sort of thing. And I thought it was absolutely excellent. I can't remember if the Ulster Rifles went with us. I think they did. Colonel Breeden would have, General Breeden would have told you that.
And when you arrived, where did you disembark?
We disembarked at Haifa, which was where we were stationed. And even before we disembarked, as far as I'm sure I remember rightly, we landed at night and disembarked next morning. But that night, one platoon had to go straight off on some, chasing some Arabs somewhere or something or other. Then we disembarked next morning in the pouring rain and marched a couple of miles to Peninsula Barracks.
What were they like?
Not bad, not at all bad. It was a permanent barracks, but not a brick barracks. It was a hutted camp, you'd call it nowadays, I suppose. But we all had a reasonable room and quite a nice mess. A sort of sand football pitch, and it was slap in the sea. I mean, some of the huts were 20 yards from the sea, and it wasn't at all bad. Outdoor cinema.
So the troops were able to take advantage of bathing?
Oh, yeah.
Did they have very much spare time?
No, not really. Really, very little. The battalion was out so much that on one occasion there was only the adjutant and the signal officer and the cooks, and they had to go out too. So it was just the guard left in camp, nobody else at all. And we used to go out on detachment and that sort of thing for about a month or two, then come back, and then when you came back, you took your turn at being on standby, and you might go out again the next day, you know, all night, and never knew. Now we were kept very busy.
Being on standby, what did that involve?
Well, we used to have, to give you an idea of the number of calls we were called on to answer, our adjutant, who was 6'4", got sick with housemaid's elbow. This is true, not a joke. He was on the telephone all day long. And we used to have an emergency company, which was at something like 12 hours notice, confined to camp, but only 12 hours notice. And then an emergency platoon, which was virtually immediate. I mean, they had to be armed, dressed, clothed, trucks already and all that sort of thing. Always.
Were the troops under much discomfort being on this?
No, not really. And like so many British soldiers, they seem to be quite happy to do practically nothing when they're not operating, except stay in bed and smoke and chat and drink beer and that sort of thing. And are delighted when they're off on a stunt, as they used to call it.
Why were they so pleased to go off?
Oh, well, most of them had been in the army for either a year or so, or several years, the chaps who'd come back from India. But they'd never done what the army is supposed to do, and they had to do a bit of fighting, you see. And they thought, this is up our street. They loved it.
And was there much fighting involved in practice?
In comparison with the last war, virtually none. But for peacetime fighting, we've been to Cyprus, Palestine, post-war Palestine, Malaya, and that sort of thing. And I would have said there was quite a reasonable amount of fighting. But, of course, all small arms stuff, you know.
Can you describe any incidents to illustrate the type of work that they were doing?
Yes. What the normal form in the battalion was, our information used to come and practice certainly nearly always through the police. And they would say they'd got information that an armed gang had just raided a village somewhere and stolen a lot of money and demanded food and that sort of thing. And then the police would come and say, well, if it was a big thing, can you send the battalion out? And sending the battalion out was very seldom very successful. It was sometimes, but very seldom, because the buzz used to get round in the most amazing mile with these Arabs, and everybody knew you were coming miles before you got there. And we used to go by truck. That was quite amusing, because we used to take donkeys with us to carry the mortar ammunition and so on, and what the donkeys get up to in the spring is no business. And then you would surround a village and search it or something. Well, sometimes we found one or two scallywags and so on. But one operation we were on, we found some chaps, including the chap we wanted to get, who was found in bed with his rifle and everything. And we were driving back, and they got the buzz and set up a sort of rescue, try and get him back again. And we were driving home in the trucks, and we got fired on from both sides of a wadi, which we had to go through. So that deployed the battalion again, and eventually we beat them back into the hills, and then they disappear. They turn into shepherds and things, unarmed and everything else, and you don't know who's what. So we got back in the trucks, went on, we came to the next village, same thing happened again. And in that sort of skirmish, I suppose we killed about 10 or 12 of them, and they killed, I think, one of ours and wounded one, something like that. And after that, we got in the trucks again and drove home. Oh, incidentally, sometimes you've got an aeroplane on these things, and you used to get warned, if you were going to be ambushed a bit, by the aeroplane shooting up something. And if he did that, it was anywhere near you, you got off and went to see where he was, sort of thing.
How did cooperation with the RAF work?
Oh, awfully well. Each battalion headquarters had a set called a number one set, and that was, you had a thing I think called an XX call, and that would get you a, Palestine's pretty small as you know, an aeroplane, or if it was thought worthwhile, more than one, usually one, in about a quarter of an hour. They were on standby all the time too, or something. And this call, who just gave a map reference, and away he came. Communication with the aeroplane was pretty dicey. It was the age-old thing of chucking a message over the side, you know. But it worked very well.
How did and could you communicate with the plane in return?
Only by sticking bayonets up with a pull through, two or three pull throughs tied together with a message in the middle, and he used to drop a hook and come along like that. It was pretty dicey.
What did you think of the people against whom you were fighting?
Well, it was rather curious. My own impression, I did an ambush, not with my battalion, but with, when I was with Wingate, with the special night squads. I'll tell you more about that later, but these particular chaps on that one were mounted, and they appeared at dawn, with the sun just coming up, galloping across a plain into the mountains. And they looked magnificent with their rifles strapped on their back and their cloaks flying and horses galloping. And they looked, it seemed a bloody shame to kill them, you know. But when we had killed them, they looked like I don't know if you've ever shot squirrels, but they look rather fine up a tree. When it falls down at the bottom, it just looks like a dead rat. That's roughly what they look like. Miserable sods, really, when they were dead. But they look rather fine galloping along.
Were they all young men?
Well, it's very difficult to tell with Arabs, because I think they age terribly quickly, and they're frightfully dirty, and don't shave much and all that sort of thing. Very difficult to tell their ages. I think they must have been fairly young, because they must have been fairly fit to get around the mountains like they did. It was interesting, one thing was that post-war in Palestine, a tremendous lot of action was taken by the Jews and the Arabs, nearly always in the cities and towns and things. But before the war, practically nothing ever happened in the towns, and it all happened out in the country, where they could sort of terrorize the villagers, I suppose, and get more money and that sort of thing. And I would have said that they were virtually illiterate, most of them, you know, that sort of thing.
Did you have any sympathy for them, or...?
Oh, yes. As a battalion, I think certainly the soldiers thought it was really an awful shame we had to kill all these poor, useless old Arabs. And they weren't a bit pro-Jewish. I don't really know why. But in my own case, one has the average Englishman's idea of a Jew or shopkeeper or anyway rolling in money sort of thing and that sort of thing. But when I went to work with Wingate, as the other two will have told you, we lived in Jewish settlements, and they were magnificent people. They worked like billy o, brave as an iron, and my view changed quite a bit then. Changed back quite a bit after the war when we went to Palestine.
Why was that?
Oh, because they fought so dirty. They were... Well, admittedly, they ran rings around us. But some of the things they did were bloody awful, really. Shocking. I mean, for no reason at all. A couple of sergeants of ours were just found hanging in a wood, you know. And then they shot a whole lot of our chaps in a car park who were in bed in the guard room sort of thing, and blowing up the King David Hotel and all that sort of stuff. It wasn't awful, you know.
Did the Arabs not adopt similar tactics before?
Oh, yes, to a certain extent. Well, there were one or two nasty little sort of small massacres, really, of Jewish settlements and people, and they were really expert. We didn't know, but we thought they must have had some German advisors on land mining. And initially, if there was army convoys going along, the first truck always blew up, which was a bit of a bore because usually it was the officer in the first truck. However, we cottoned on to that, and then they developed a system which could be any truck. Apparently it was a sort of cogwheel that went round in each truck, turned it once, and when number 8 turned up, his number was on it, and up it went. So he didn't know which truck was going to blow up. They were very good at that. They did a lot of it, too.
Did that those type of tactics create the same sense of bitterness amongst the British troops that the Jewish tactics after the war?
No, I don't think they did. No. I can't possibly say why, but no, they didn't. I'm certain they didn't. The troops were pretty bitter against the Jews after the war, and they virtually had no contact, except for us, with Wingate, with them before the war. And, well, we had a few casualties and this, that and the other, but I don't think they bore any resentment to them. In the same way, I understand, I was never there, that the chaps, whatever they are called, in the northwest frontier of India, used to lose certain amount of troops, but I don't think I think they thought the Pathans or whatever they were really rather fine chaps.
Was the difference in feeling perhaps because the Arabs were less effective than the Jews were later?
No, I don't think so, because so were we from that point of view. I mean, the weapons and things after the war were much more sophisticated than anything we had out there before the war. On both sides, all sides.
Why did you think that the Arabs had German advisers?
I don't know. The buzz... Well, because we didn't think that they were clever enough, really, to invent these mines, things like that. And I've no idea. I suppose there were a certain amount of German Arabs in Palestine. Presumably. I mean, they're all nationalities. But I don't know. Certainly I got the impression from some buzz going around the barracks or something that probably the Germans had done it.
What did you think of the soldierly qualities of the people against whom you were operating?
Not much. It was a... Well, if they attacked a Jewish settlement, it was 10-1 they'd win, because the Jews weren't allowed anything much to protect themselves. And so the Arabs probably outnumbered them arms-wise, and not men-wise, but arms-wise, 10-1 every time, and they were bound to win. Well, there's nothing frightfully clever in that. And against us, as I say, it was either fairly long-range ambush so that they could just disappear and say, I know nothing about this, I haven't got a weapon or anything, they buried them or something. So it wasn't very clever at all. The Jews, after the war, were brilliant.
Why were the Jews so good? Why do you say they were so brilliant?
Because they ran rings around us. And they literally did. I mean, they pulled off the most fantastic coups. For instance, after the war, they had just bust open Acre Jail, which was a hell of a feat, and got the chaps all out, too. Yeah, and then they disappeared, too. But, they pulled off some brilliant manoeuvres. After the war, one was the incident called the barrel bomb. They blew up Haifa police station, which had outside it a large thick barbed wire thing about the height of this room. And the Jews devised a bomb on top of a lorry with a ramp on it, all covered by, as it turned out, to be a sort of paper canopy, and just drove up past the police station and pulled the plug, off-rolled the barrel, away went the lorry, and up went the police station just as easy as that.
You said that the Jews ran rings round you after the war, but would you say that your operations against the Arabs before the war were much more effective?
Ours?
Yes.
Yes, I think so. We didn't really have anything frightfully effective except, I mean, the large-scale stopping immigration after the war, when we sent them all over to Cyprus and so on. But against the Jews themselves, well, we never got a chance, really. We couldn't find the sods.
But weren't the Arabs before the war elusive as well?
Oh, very. Yes. Yes, they were. Now, I think about out of umpteen hundred operations before the war, one in 15 or 20 produced some result, you know. And after the war, hardly anything produced any result except to make it a bit more difficult for them, you know.
To what extent do you think the Arabs against whom you were operating were receiving voluntary help from the Arab villagers?
Voluntary? None, I should say. I think the only voluntary sort of contribution they would give would be Royal Sergeant Major, three volunteers, you and you. And they're also quite ruthless, I think. I think if the village didn't ante up, they'd say, right, we'll burn it down or shoot all half the men or something like that. Now, I don't think there was any voluntary stuff.
Did you have evidence of this terrorisation of the Arab villagers?
Don't think I ever did, but I think the police did. We worked very closely with the police and always had the police with us when we went anywhere, but no, I don't think I ever came across any evidence. But I mean, if you see a bust down thing, it's difficult to tell. They're also ramshackle anyway.
What opinion did you and your brother officers have of the police?
On the whole, I'd say very high. It's difficult. The British police were mostly very young, and I found most cooperative and helpful. But in a police force, when half are Arab and half are Jew, and the problems come from the Arabs and the Jews, and the other smaller bit is English, you're bound to get a certain amount of collusion, I think, which I don't think we ever came across. And the ones we worked with were jolly good, very good.